Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month, the speaker is John Norquist. Norquist is the president and CEO of the Congress for the New Urbanism. Norquist served three terms as mayor of Milwaukee. He's credited with a decline in poverty, a boom in new downtown housing, and helping that city become a leading center of education and welfare reform. Norquist is also the author of The Wealth of Cities. He writes in the book that excessive federal funding of freeways spurred the growth of car dependency that has hurt American cities.
So I'm going to talk to you a little bit. I know a little bit about Fort Wayne in that I've been here over a period of approximately 53 years from time to time, but not very often. When I was a little kid, I lived in Rushville, which is quite a bit south of here. And then later on, when I got older and I was in the second and third grade, I lived in Muncie, Indiana. And so I was a Hoosier, I can't remember the right way to pronounce it. And then shortly thereafter moved to Illinois and then Wisconsin, and now I live in Chicago. So I'm very familiar with Indiana and Indiana cities, and Fort Wayne is a city that people are always surprised when they come here and see how big it is, because they thought maybe it would just be no bigger than, say, Anderson or Fostoria, Ohio, or something like that. But Fort Wayne actually is a fairly large city with a real downtown and beautiful neighborhoods. I got lost on the way here and ended up on Anthony Boulevard, which is a beautiful, beautiful street, at least this part of the street that I saw. There's another part that Deputy Mayor was telling me about that has construction work going on it, but I didn't hit that part. But anyway, so Fort Wayne is a Midwestern city in the population class of places like Des Moines and Grand Rapids. It has potentially a tremendous future, and I'm going to tell you some of the things you ought to do in order to have a better future. And one of the things to do is appreciate what Fort Wayne is and not try too hard to change it in ways that cost a lot of money. And I'll explain by what I mean by that. I have a book called The Wealth of Cities. And my philosophy while I was mayor of Milwaukee from 1988 to 2004 was that the city of Milwaukee should try to do things that add value to the city. We shouldn't just do things if there happens to be money laying around someplace that somebody wants to spend money on, or we shouldn't do things if some interest group demands money and says the city will fall apart unless they get the money. You have to question that notion once in a while. And we ought to go with where the real value of the city is. And the real value of cities like Milwaukee, or for that matter, Fort Wayne, is the complexity of the city. The fact that you have so much diversity of economic activity, personal activity, culture, all these things come together. That's what makes any city of any size an interesting place and a valuable place where people would want to be. And so that, I'm going to talk about three aspects of that today. One, I'm going to go first to design. I'm going to show some slides. Then I'm going to talk about the economics of cities. And then finally, I'm going to talk about school choice and school choice vouchers and why Milwaukee had them. I'm not saying you have to have them, but, well, actually, I will be saying that you have to have them. Get around to that. So the Congress for the New Urbanism, it's a group of about 3,000 architects, planners, traffic engineers, developers, community activists, real estate investors, people that believe in urbanism, believe in the urban form, which was pretty stigmatized early on in the 20th century. But now is starting to be appreciated more. This is the sprawl that we often talk about. And it has distinct ingredients, and it's not caused by an accident of nature. It's not caused by the free market system. Milton Friedman didn't make it happen. It happened because of government interference. And the government interferes all the time, for better or worse. The government interfered in World War II, and we won. That was a good interference. And you can argue about all the different ones. I happen to think Social Security and Medicare are good interferences. Other people might not agree. But there is an interference in this, and there are two of them that I want to draw your attention to. One is separate use zoning, which separates all of the human activity into pods. And your old downtown, if you went back in a time machine 50 years, was mixed use with housing, retail, offices, all together. And then if you look at the development over the last 30, 40 years in, around Fort Wayne, it's tended to be separate use with residential in one pod, and that divided up between apartments, never around houses. Everything's separated, retail, office. The net effect of that is to create this kind of situation. The other is the streets. The streets, which the old streets of Fort Wayne, would have three purposes, and that's true of streets in human history ever since streets were built thousands of years ago. The three purposes are movement, social, and economic. And it's been dumbed down under the Federal Highway Administration and under the DOT, including the Indiana DOT, to only one thing, movement. And the culture and the economics don't matter anymore. And that, there's a problem with that, which I'll show you. The separate use zoning, getting back to that, it's like this is a drawing by Leo Creer, who's the architect who advises Prince Charles in London. But the sprawl is like if you took the ingredients of the pizza and didn't put them together or cook them, and just ate them separately, whereas a properly composed city where you mix things together properly, you end up with something that's you'd want to consume. This is a drawing of Le Corbusier's City of Tomorrow, and this is where the first idea of the great separated highways came from. This is from 1922, and Le Corbusier was a socialist. For a while, he was even a communist, and he's one of the fathers of sprawl. So, yes, I'm implying, maybe unfairly, that sprawl is a communist plot. And this is how he did it. Now, this is Crystal City, just outside Reagan Airport, just across the river from Washington, D.C. It used to be called National Airport. Now it's Reagan Airport. Anyway, this is his drawing. You can see it. There it was, and here it is in modern form. And it's that way on the edges of almost all the major American cities. The road has been converted into nothing more than a conduit for traffic. You can't walk on it legally. You can't even do what I did, take that picture. That's an illegal picture. But the statute of limitations is run, so it's okay. And this is the road that is typically built, whether you'd be in the Midwest or in the south or the west or whatever, the 72-foot arterial, if you were building a new arterial street on the edge of Fort Wayne, and the Indiana DOT and the public works people get together, this is what they would most likely do. 72 feet of pavement with 20-foot median, so there can be double pork chop, left turn lane at the intersections. No money left over for a sidewalk, so you end up with that dirt path forming, and huge clear zones to supposedly make the road safer, even though all the studies that are coming out now, like the one out of Texas A&M's Transportation Institute, show that clear zones actually create more serious traffic accidents and death because people just drive faster. And here's another version of it. From a pedestrian standpoint, these roads are tough. You can walk in a dirt path or you can walk in the gutter. And when Americans are asked, well, you know, why do we have the love affair with the automobile? Well, this is a choice that's been given to us. You can ride in one of those pickup trucks and be an American, or you can be the criminal suspect that's walking along the street. This is Le Corbusier. He was actually Swiss, but he was from the French part of Switzerland. Le Corbusier's ideas are still very seductive, even many years after he died. If you go to Harvard School of Design, you'll see students that have glasses exactly like this, mimicking him. And this is his vertical expression. You had the Great Separated Highway, which, you know, made sense. I mean, the whole idea of the Great Separated Highway made sense. You had the automobile, you had congestion at the intersections, why not separate them? And so he wanted to do this in Paris, the Jewish quarter on the west bank of the Seine, the right bank of the Seine, and all of the intersections would have been Great Separated, and it would have destroyed several billion dollars worth of real estate value that's there today. And so the Parisians rejected it and just put these buildings out in the suburbs, or the banlieue, as they call them. This is the Pruitt-Igoe project in St. Louis, 1955, 20 years it came down later. It was built by a disciple of Corbusier. But it's not just the modernists and it's not just the sophisticates that come up with the ideas behind sprawl, that created sprawl. It was also specialization. For example, the idea that you needed to widen streets that already existed. This is National Avenue in Milwaukee, and there was a setback so that when a building was lost, the new building had to be built about 30 feet back from the street so they could widen the street someday. And that basically declared property death for this three-mile-long street on one side of the street. All of that property value lost. Just like when the city of Chicago tore down Block 37, and they had 118 property owners in 22 buildings on that block. That was 27 years ago, and they haven't collected any property tax since. And all of the taxpayers were current. And so when you start taking property as a city government, you always have to calculate in who's going to pay when you take it away. And so we changed this. We changed the rules so these setbacks disappeared. If a property owner lost a building from fire or demolition or whatever, they could build the building right back up to the street line without a variance. And this is starting to happen all over. In Chicago, which has a much better building code now than it did in the past, more pro-urban, Home Depot figured out how to build this building on Halstead and Lincoln Park, right up on the street, parking in front with meters. There's some parking hidden under the building in a parking lot. Two-story building. If you took Home Depot off that building and put Nordstrom's on it, it would fit right in. So this urbanism is starting to be rediscovered, how to do it. A Walmart in Milwaukee next to another building. In fact, they're building a building right next to it right now that would actually touch a Walmart building. So Walmart is starting to open up to urbanism, to environmentalism. There's only one issue that they're going to be rigid on for a long time, and that's unions. They don't want any unions. And that's not CNU's issue. I mean, I'm a Democrat and all that sort of thing, but on the other hand, I got elected four times without AFSCME, so, you know, I can see the various points of view on these things. This is another example of specialization destroying a city, which I'm sure that you've had examples of in Fort Wayne. And that's the parking specialists. In this case, there was a building with a 18-foot frontage, and the parking regulation required 7 off-street parking spots on the site because people were all worried about parking. Oh, my God, parking. What are we going to do without it? And so the building, once the regulation passed, for 30 years, the building was empty. We repealed the regulation that required the parking, and they started building it so fast I couldn't get out there to take a picture fast enough. But that's what they put in there. Right away, the empty lot was filled. Another example of this is bowling alleys. Some parking planner, we think in Ohio, Don Shoup, who's an economics professor at UCLA, says it started in Ohio, in Lima or Fostoria. He hasn't figured which one yet. But a planner was asked, how many parking spots for a bowling alley? And instead of the planner saying the sensible thing, I don't know, and who cares, he said 5. 5 per lane. So you have 5 spots per lane. And you wonder why all these bowling alleys popped up in the 60s and 70s with the giant sea of parking around them and all the other bowling alleys gradually disappeared. Well, there's probably other reasons, too, but one of the reasons was that parking regulation, which spread through the whole Midwest. It spread all the Midwestern states have that parking regulation. Go look for it. You'll find it. And it's completely stupid, nonsensical. as I said, the modernism, the idea is that we need a utopian modern environment, go away very slowly. That's still very seductive. Zaha Hadid was going to design these dormitories for the New York Olympics if they'd got them in 2012, but they were turned down. The other great modernist who helped create sprawl was Walter Gropius, who my wife's great aunt was his personal assistant and knew him really well. And when we go to New Hampshire to the summer place, I get to read some of his letters, which were actually pretty steamy. But I'm not going to get into that today. But Gropius, he was a modernist from what they called the Berlin School. World War One was offensive to the whole modern movement. In fact, the World War One created it. They were reacting against it, and so they wanted to get rid of the old architecture of the empire, the boulevard, the street, the avenue, and put in these great separations and all the anti-urban forms. And one of those urban forms they got rid of, and Gropius, after he left Germany, and he left Germany for high moral reasons. He was a social democrat, and the Nazis had him on a list to put in prison. So he left in 1934, became head of the Harvard School of Design. But this is one of the influences that he had, because he was so much against what he saw as the imperial architecture, but was actually the architecture of civilization for thousands of years, the terminated vista. And this is Port Washington in Wisconsin, their main street, with St. Mary's Church up on the hill, the ordinary buildings on each side. And this was built out in the 1880s and 90s, and they didn't have a big architect or planner. They took it from a pattern book from the Austrian Empire and put this in place. And it's worth a lot of money today. It's a great place. Everybody loves to go there. But Gropius, in his curriculum at Harvard, which spread through all the design schools, including Indiana, they picked up on those ideas of eliminating the terminated vista as a form. And so it disappeared from America and wasn't built anywhere in the United States, as far as I've been able to find, for almost 50 years, except in two places. And one of those is this one in Orlando. The other one's in Anaheim, because Disney understood that a beautiful street with a terminated vista at the head of it would attract tourists. There's a pen and ink drawing from northern Italy with the bell tower and the ordinary buildings, the Chicago Board of Trade, adding value to the real estate all along LaSalle Street. It's fun to walk on LaSalle Street, particularly if you're going south with this building to look at. And it added tremendous, tremendous value. And in 17th century Holland, when they had all that money from the tulips and everything else, they built beautiful scenes like this. So if they could do it in the 17th century, can't we do it again today? And the answer is yes, and we are. And here it is, Target. This is the Target at Gaithersburg, the old Washingtonian Mall, which was torn down, and they put in streets and blocks, just like a regular city, with ordinary buildings on each side and the monumental one at the head of the street. They're very ordinary buildings on each side. There's a Dunkin' Donuts on the left with a parking lot above, and a Starbucks with a bookstore above it on the right. So you can sort of separate culturally. You can be a Dunkin' Donuts person, or you can be a Starbucks person. Or you can go around the corner to Kohl's, the same thing. The developers are bringing back this old form because it makes money. And downtown Fort Wayne is already shaped like this. It already has buildings set on blocks and streets. And so I predict that in the long run, you'll find more and more value in downtown Fort Wayne. And in Milwaukee, without a developer even being involved in this case, the great modernist, or not modernist, but contemporary architect Santiago Calatrava, without even being prompted, designed the addition to the art museum to terminate the vista on Milwaukee's biggest street, Wisconsin Avenue. Now, this urbanism stuff has really started to pay off, and you can see it in the Chicago metropolitan area. Wicker Park, which was on the verge of being a slum 30 years ago, is now one of the most valuable neighborhoods in Chicago, or even in the metropolitan area. And it's very simple. It doesn't have a lot of expensive infrastructure, other than it does have the L, which has been there for 100 years. But it has streets that are really simple. This is the main intersection of the neighborhood. One moving lane in each direction on the three streets that come together here at Devon, Milwaukee Avenue, and North Avenue. And one moving lane in each direction with parking all day. These streets are carrying 25, 30,000 cars, more traffic than any of your streets in downtown here with the one-ways, and with no parking allowed on the streets, which is insane because you can't be a retail merchant if people can't park in front of the store. It's not that they're actually going to get the spot in front of the store, but they have to have the illusion that they're going to get that spot. If you take the illusion away, they're not even going to try. And so if Wicker Park can do the 25, 30,000 cars a day on these streets and parking all day, even at rush hour, because the merchants rule, they give more money to the alderman than the traffic engineer does. And so this is one case where the taint actually works to the benefit of the city. Or in Toronto, this is Dundas Street. It has this major streetcar line, one moving lane in each direction, shared by the vehicles. Retail on the first floor, apartments above, and it's a horribly congested street, and everybody wants to be there. And the real estate prices prove it. Or in Milwaukee, Kinnikinick Avenue. This is the street that you have all over this town, the same dimensions, the two-rod street, two rods from the center lane to the building line, or four rods if you did the whole thing. 50 feet of pavement and 7-foot sidewalks. Retail on the first floor, and all kinds of variety on these streets. Imagine, without the separate use zoning, you have hardware, liquor stores, you have clothing stores, bars, and then after you've been there, you can walk down the street and confess at a Catholic church, all on the same street, all these buildings together, creating this wonderful place. Now, in the contemporary, the last 30 or 40 years, have you ever heard of a church not being built without an entire block of parking to itself? It's ridiculous. It's like somehow God is meant to be all about parking. And that's not only a bad thing to do, in my opinion, as a Presbyterian minister's son, it's a sin. Okay, now here's where we want to be. Now, the most stunning example is the city, which I'm going to talk about now, where the failure of the federal and state transportation policies have ruined some of our cities, damaged them. And this city is the city that has only one thing it can brag about in its whole history. Anybody want to guess what city this is? Okay, I'll tell you. This is a city that stole the Pistons from Fort Wayne. This is Detroit. And this is Detroit in 1946 when my parents had their honeymoon there. My dad was a Bataan Death March survivor from Minnesota. And if you were from Minnesota or Michigan and you were a Bataan Death March survivor, you could go to the Nicolet Hotel in Minneapolis or the Cadillac Hotel in Detroit. And he lived in St. Paul, so they went to Detroit. And Detroit was a vibrant place then. It was the most successful city in the whole world in World War II in producing ammunition, guns, jeeps, tanks, you name it. And it came out of World War II. It had 300 miles of streetcar lines, three department stores downtown, including Hudson's, the world's biggest at the time. And then they started cleaning it up. They put freeways all through it. They wanted to get rid of the traffic congestion they had. Here's Hudson's 35 years later being torn down. And this is Berlin. At the end of World War II in May 1945, they lost. The Nazis lost. The Germans lost. And Berlin was 70% destroyed. And now this is Berlin today. Potsdamer Platz. This is where the wall went through. The biggest intersection in Berlin before World War II. And now it is again. And that's where the wall went. And there was nothing there. Now it's all built up. It's like Times Square. And here's Detroit. About 35% of the building sites that had buildings on them in 1946 would now be empty land or ground level or pheasant in the alley. You know, the U.S. DOT and the Michigan DOT had as their objective to conquer congestion. And from that standpoint, Detroit is the most successful city in the United States because they don't have a problem with congestion, except when the Lions play or maybe the Tigers. But other than that, they don't have a problem with congestion. They have big roads. They've taken the grid and torn it up and created super blocks and busted up their boulevard system, tore out their streetcar system, and they have a city that isn't worth very much. And it looks, if you ask somebody that didn't know anything about history and you showed them Berlin or you showed them Stalingrad, which is now Volgograd, or Nagasaki or Hiroshima, Tokyo, Dresden, all the cities that were flattened, Rotterdam, and you show them Detroit, and they think World War II happened right here in the United States. That's what the policies have done. Here's Milwaukee in 1956, a black community, Walnut Street. That's the way it looked after the Wisconsin Highway Department improved it. And there's a lot of side effects, and they put up these barriers with the concrete. Steel-reinforced concrete works best for sound barriers. And it's the only surviving technology of the old East German Republic. You can see the prototype here, the Berlin Wall. If Erich Honecker, the last leader of East Germany, if he came to life in Berlin, he'd be totally disoriented. He could go to San Antonio. The Martin Luther King Drive, this is how we honor Dr. King, with this kind of road. See, the only purpose of the road now is like a traffic sewer. There's nothing else to it, just moving the traffic. The Champs-Élysées in Paris, you have 58,000 cars a day on that Champs-Élysées. Beautiful street with billions of dollars of real estate value, and it moves more traffic than any road within 100 miles of here. This is how the auto industry presents their vehicles, either in the woods or in the city. This is Prague with the Charles Bridge in the background, which doesn't meet Federal Highway Administration standards. All their bridges fail our standards. Imagine what the U.S. DOT could do to Prague. We could put interchanges like this. We could tear down Wenceslaus Square. That's what they did in Detroit. But these things are falling down. They cost too much money, and even with stimulus money, they cost more money than they have. And so the dream is grinding to a halt. We have to change the dream so it's a better dream. The West Side Highway in New York fell down in 1973. It was replaced with a street, West Street. The Embarcadero fell down in 89, was replaced with a boulevard. Values went up 350% when they made the decision not to rebuild the freeway. In Milwaukee, without an earthquake, we tore down this freeway and building up all the property along the river nearby, over $280 million of development so far, without any subsidy. You subsidize, you stigmatize. That was my view. And the most dramatic example of all in the world, which is now spreading all over Asia, the attitude and the plan, in Seoul, Korea, right after the Korean War, the United States helped Korea build this double-deck freeway right through the middle of Seoul, covering up the river. And the mayor who was elected in 2001 didn't like that. They tore out the river. It's the way it looks now. Billions of dollars of real estate value. They act quickly in Korea. There's the mayor, who's now the president, Lee Mok-bong. President of South Korea. Look how happy he is. That's what happens if you have the courage to do the right thing, which he did. And what happened to the traffic? Nothing. It disappeared. There's two moving lanes on each side, just regular streets. They put a new transit line in, but you know, there's no freeway that replaced it. The traffic just disappeared into the grid. They didn't need it. And this is the Seattle Alaskan Viaduct, which we're working with the Pioneer Avenue Business Association and others to tear down. The mayor opposed us on this, and he just got beat last week. So, you know, that's what happens if you don't listen to the people. We went to the DOT in Washington. They said, well, this road is so important, it couldn't possibly live without it. Even though almost all the truck traffic was in and out of downtown, it wasn't through traffic. So we said, well, Vancouver's 100 miles away. They don't have a road like that. There's Vancouver. They have the richest real estate market in Canada. And you could give them one, though. You know, put it in. Or Portland, they tore out their waterfront freeway in 1970. Put it back. Would that be a good thing? Or Paris. How would they? They would be blessed with it, I'm sure. Okay, I'm getting close to the end here, and then I'll very quickly get into school choice. But this is an issue that's an engineering issue. It's a math issue. It's a design and standards issue. And we understand it now with water. We don't go in and drain wetlands because we think they're useless. Occasionally it might still happen for some reason that's just overwhelmingly powerful. But we know that wetlands have value. They absorb flooding. It's a setting for wildlife and plants that we value. It helps clean the water. Those are all good things. Even the Army Corps of Engineers now realizes that you don't want to channelize these streams. But we do the same thing to our cities, taking these big highways and tearing down neighborhoods and building suburbs that are totally a car-oriented, does the same thing. It's just as dumb. It's the same math. It wastes a ton of money, money that could be used for streets. Even the road builders could make money. Just build lots of little streets instead of just a few giant big ones. And there's this thing called a road hierarchy or the functional classification system. And it dominates. It just dominates American development patterns to the point where, and it's so counterproductive. That's one of the reasons our energy consumption is higher than any other advanced industrial country per capita, is because of it. And we need to change it. And it's right in front of your face. The right way to do it is right here. You can just see it in the older parts of Fort Wayne. Or in Washington, D.C., the L'Enfant plant. So valuable. What a great setting for real estate. And it works better. At rush hour, Connecticut Avenue runs at 8 to 13 miles an hour and carries more traffic than the Whitehurst Freeway, which is roughly parallel and goes at 2 to 6 miles per hour at peak hour. The freeways don't even work when you need them the most. They only work in the middle of the night. So we're changing that. CNU is working with the Institute of Transportation Engineers, a very conservative, formal group, to try to re-legitimize the boulevard and the avenue, the street. And we're trying to get Al Gore to pay attention. I'm going to be critical of Al Gore for a moment here, if you don't mind. He's all for stopping climate change, but then he never mentions anything that's all that controversial. Because he got the sweats during the 2000 campaign, so he stopped talking about land use and transportation because his consultants told him, but he hasn't started talking about it again. All he talks about is light bulbs and things like that, building materials, you know, nothing that would get anybody excited. He did deserve the Nobel Prize. I'm not knocking him overall. But he's wrong when he doesn't realize the effect of land use and transportation, which he realizes. He just won't say anything about it. This is the HSBC Bank, there used to be called the Hong Kong Bank, big bank. It had its headquarters in Chicago, and about 8 years ago it moved out to 17 miles out of town, and it got a gold green building award, LEED award, for environmental leadership. Whatever savings were made in energy from the building materials was washed out 10 times over by all the employees then having to drive. It wasn't anywhere near a metro stop. And so we've challenged that. We're challenging Gore. We're challenging the green building people. We don't just fool around challenging people on the right. We do it on the left, too. And here's just a drawing. It shows you the effect in Chicago. We always think of pollution as being in the middle and not on the edge. But who creates the pollution? People who live on the edge drive more and produce more pollution. But there's solutions, and we're very positive about that in CNU. We have answers for anything. We might not be right all the time, but we have answers. And one of them is, this is Cisco's headquarters in the Santa Clara Valley. And this is what they're starting to do. Their employees need housing, so they're putting in housing, and they're turning this corporate executive park that was hot, on a hot day, it was hotter than any place else, and ugly and horrible place. And now they're turning it into a real city. And so that shows you what private sector can do when they open up their minds. And we're having our next big meeting, November 4th through 6th in Portland, Oregon. It's for traffic engineers and planners and people like that, but if you want to know about it, go to our website, cnu.org. All right, now, I'll leave that there. I'm going to go right into economics. Cities are valuable because of their complexity. Cities are valuable because they're open to the market. They're more relevant to the market than any other form of government. The national governments, empires, provinces, they're all artificial creations, and they come and go. Damascus has had mostly bad rulers for the last 4,000 years. The Romans, the Greeks, current government, they're all kind of the Ottoman Empire. But Syria, despite that, Damascus has been a magnificent city. It's been a market city. And that's what cities are all about. And that's what Fort Worth should find. Find the market. What makes the market work? And things that don't make the market work are subsidies that defy economics or defy the marketplace, that screw up the market. If you have, like in Milwaukee, I'll tell you, I'm not going to badmouth anybody here, but in Milwaukee, our electric power company did a lot of wonderful things. They give money to charity, but they thought they were a developer. And every time they were a developer, they thought there was a gap. And the gap had to be filled by reaching into the taxpayer's pocket, pulling money out and putting it into their project, even though they were the biggest capitalized place around. That's the attitude that people have about cities. Somehow the city's a cash machine. You just go. So we stopped subsidizing. In 1997, we stopped subsidizing housing in our downtown. We changed the zoning code to make it easy to convert office buildings, even office buildings like the ones that you have. And you have, Lori Volk has been here and talked about how you can convert office space to housing. And we had a boom, 6,000 new housing units in downtown Milwaukee. You go there, it's an exciting city, even though I lost on my big battle for transit, which is unfortunate because I was right about getting that transit line, but I just couldn't quite win. Someday the new mayor, I think, will probably win on that. But we did, despite that, we still made the downtown attractive because we allowed good zoning, we had a good zoning code, and then we didn't subsidize stuff. We made it happen. If you're going to subsidize something, you subsidize something that people can't do on their own. Developers, they have money. They have banks. They have all kinds of stuff. They can go get money. Banks have money right now. They just don't want to lend it because they think they'll get more return on it next year than they will this year. Now we're going to get to school choice, and then I'll shut up. I'm a Democrat. I'm a big city Democrat. I'm an anti-war Democrat. I served in the military in the United States Army from 71 to 77. But I think it's dumber than hell to have gone in these wars, like Iraq, and we had to get out of Afghanistan, just like Charles de Gaulle, the great military man of France, had enough sense to just pull out of Algeria. If they'd stayed another 10 years there, they would have done the same thing they did the previous 10 years. So I'm a liberal Democrat by that standard. And I can tell you right now that having the school monopoly placed on American kids in the cities in America undermines the whole value of the city to produce education. And if you look at education in the United States, it ranks below most of the advanced industrial communities for K-12, and it ranks above everybody else for higher education. And where do we have choice? In higher education, you have private schools, religious schools, you have all public universities, and they all have access to the GI Bill, the Pell Grants, they have all that, and cities are the place where most of the great universities are. You have your universities and colleges right here. They're here because Fort Wayne is here, because it's a big, interesting place. It's a good place to have a college. Same thing's true with Indianapolis, or the same thing's true with Madison, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee, which has several universities. University is a good place. That should be true of K through 12, too. Have you ever heard of anybody saying, I want to go to get into a big city so my kid can go to the public schools there? You don't hear that. Well, look at Detroit. There's not one affluent family with their kids in the Detroit public schools. And the Catholic system has collapsed. But they do have school choice. It's connected directly to real estate. Directly to real estate. You can go to a public school outside Detroit. That's your choice. And the unions don't care because you'll be in a union school in Grosse Pointe school system or the Pontiac school system, so it's okay. I even debated somebody from the NEA once, and they said, Well, the people in the suburbs of Detroit, they were from the Michigan Education Association, the people in the suburbs of Detroit, they don't want it. They don't want school choice. They don't want to have anything to do with Detroit. Now, there's a Christian attitude. Let those people rot. Even though they go more to church as a percentage of population than probably the people out in the suburbs. Just let them rot. Well, that's not the attitude that I wanted to have about Milwaukee. So I supported school choice, and we got it. It was a coalition of blacks, Hispanics, and Catholic ethnics who said they didn't want to see all their choices, and they didn't want the only choice to be to move out of town. Why should that be your only choice? If you're in Toronto, you don't have that choice. In Toronto, you've got families living downtown. They don't think anything of it. Downtown's a great place for a kid to live. There's all kinds of neat stuff to do. There's great parks, universities, all kinds of playgrounds. So people live in Toronto. They don't say, I want to go to Mississauga. I have a 3-year-old about to enter school. I got to get out of here. But in Detroit, if somebody lived in one of those lofts that they've managed to develop in the old Tiger Stadium neighborhood, and they have a 3-year-old, and they have money, they're out of town. They're out of there. It's gotten so bad there aren't even private schools for them to go to. In Chicago, at least they have that. My son goes to Parker, and I don't feel guilty about it because I was for school choice when I lived in Milwaukee. And my son went to a school in the city that had over 50% minority population, and it was a great school, and parents wanted their kids in that school, and it happened to be private. But what happened in Milwaukee, and now I'll wind up because I'm sure the time is getting short. What happened in Milwaukee, because of school choice, the public schools had to compete, but they ended up getting even more money than they had before, between property taxes and the money from the state. It grew more than the rate of inflation. And the private schools got better. The idea that Catholic schools are perfect is ridiculous. There's all kinds of problems with Catholic schools. We don't even need to go there. You can talk about Lutheran schools, which are good. The Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod Lutheran, which is interesting because the Missouri and Wisconsin Synod Lutherans are evangelical Christians, and they believe in creationism, which I don't, at least that form of it. But when I was debating some guy that was against school choice, he said, why, they're teaching creationism. And I said, you know what? When it's all said and done, those kids are going to be able to spell creation. And when they get out of school someday, maybe they'll go to college and they'll get a different view of things and they'll look at it differently than they would if as a grade school student. But they learn how to read and write. They have really good results out of those schools. So Milwaukee's had success. They've had so much success with it that the child population has gone up. The city's population has gone up. It was dipping down to around 570. Now it's back over 600,000. There's other reasons for that, not just that. But all of a sudden, Milwaukee's a center of innovation for K-12 education, and people can't say, well, I got to move out of town. Now, they might want to move out of town because they love mowing their lawn all weekend. I don't, you know, there's all kinds of reasons to live way out there. But schools aren't necessarily the reason. And the same thing with Washington, D.C., which is under threat. Barack Obama's kids, and I voted for Barack Obama, but Barack Obama's kids go to Sidwell Friends, where my wife went to school when she was in grade school. And that's a wonderful school. And it's also a school choice school in Washington. And about 20 kids every year are able to enroll in Sidwell Friends, unless it gets stopped. And right now, there's bills in both houses that aren't probably going to pass to keep it going. And they're going to kill school choice in Washington, D.C. And those kids, no new kids in Washington are going to be able to go to Sidwell unless they're really rich. And that's a tragedy. And Obama's embarrassed about it. He knows he's embarrassed about it because his kids go to one of those schools. And they love that school. And they can afford to be there. But if it's good enough for his kids, why isn't it good enough for some kids in Washington, D.C.? And in Fort Wayne, it would work, too, with Catholics, private schools, and the public schools. And the public schools don't disappear. Public schools have advantages. There's public schools in Milwaukee that are far better than some of the private schools. It actually has worked out where people move back and forth between them. It turned out that more people with disabilities went into the private schools than went into the public schools. Strange phenomenon, not the most severe ones, but things like reading disorders. All kinds of things happen, and if you look at that data, you can see it worked. And there's other options, too, which Robert Enlow here could tell you about, including school tax credits and all kinds of ways to do it. There's many roads to school choice. But you have to have some kind of choice other than people with money separating themselves from people who don't have money. Because that's the American way of choice in most of America today. And it's pretty disgusting. And it needs to change. And it's against the interests of cities. The major value of cities is as a place where you have lots of people conveniently close together doing lots of things that are mutually supportive. Millions of transactions every day creating more value. That's what cities are all about. And that's true of education, too. The fact that the scale, you can't have school choice in Minot, North Dakota. There's not enough people for choice there. Even restaurant choice, they're kind of short on that. So the city is the place where it can happen. So if you want education to get better in Fort Wayne, really go look at charters, tax credits, and vouchers and other things like that, and take the heat and make it happen, and this city will be a great place, as well as with all the other things I talked about on in economics and in terms of design. Thank you very much.
John Norquist is the CEO and president of the Center for the New Urbanism. He was the longtime mayor of Milwaukee and has taught courses in urban policy and urban planning at the University of Chicago, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning, and at Marquette University. A local Indiana group shares some of Norquist's concerns. Brian Payne is the CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. He talks about new urbanism in Indianapolis. He says one good example is the Cultural Trail,
which we are, along with the city, the lead organization behind it at the Central Indiana Community Foundation. So there's huge support of the Cultural Trail. That has the added benefit of being so innovative. We like to say, and we actually know that this is true, and it's been backed up in many national publications, that the Cultural Trail is bigger, bolder, and more beautiful than any other urban greenway trail that's being developed or has been developed in the world. We're really taking that whole concept of a bicycle pedestrian trail and walkway to a whole new level, and where design is just as important as the destinations, where we're really carving out so much space for people and taking it from cars, and we've been very careful to make sure that there's still that good, you know, quality auto flow in downtown. And actually, one of the things we're excited about is we're going to create with the Cultural Trail an experience, a piece of infrastructure that other cities are going to want to copy. We've already hosted 6 or 7 cities. And the bigger cities aren't going to be able to copy because they're overwhelmed with cars. Their patterns are set. They already have gridlock in their downtowns. I'm thinking of course, San Francisco, Boston, New York, though New York has done something pretty interesting with Broadway, where they've now taken a bunch of Broadway and taken it away from cars and given it back to people. And, in fact, in the New York Times just this week, there's a great kind of series of photographs about how people are creating these, are coming to Broadway in downtown Manhattan or midtown Manhattan with these incredibly interesting bicycles. But we're really leapfrogging the whole world in this. So that's one example. Another example, though, is in the neighborhoods. There is a new understanding in all of our neighborhoods that if you're going to make our neighborhoods better, it has to be through a comprehensive approach. So it's not just building nicer houses or dealing with abandoned homes. It is that. That's very important. But if you do that without putting in new sidewalks or sidewalks for the first time, if you do that and don't create a way to connect to our greenway trail system, then you're not really going to be successful. And there is that kind of new understanding that it is houses and parks and greenway trails and walkability and places to walk to, like nice retail areas. So this legacy project that the city has taken on with the Super Bowl, It has a lot of partners. We're happy to be one of the partners, but there's many, many partners in the community. On the East Side development that's referred to as the Legacy Project of Super Bowl, you know, there is a huge focus on affordable apartments, on housing, and that's great, and we're fully supportive of that. But there's also, you know, they want to connect the cultural trail to other trails that reach the East Side. They're talking about a gateway to create a sense of place that you're now on the East Side, welcome to the East Side, a beautiful piece of design that would say, this is a great place, come on in. And then there's also a committee that's focused on East 10th Street commercial revitalization. So it's the whole package. I mean, and sidewalks are so important to this. So that's all a way of getting back to the old urbanism.
That's Brian Payne. He's the CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, we'll hear from Angela Braley. She's the president and chief executive officer of WellPoint Incorporated. The Indianapolis-based company is the nation's leading health benefits company, serving approximately 35 million medical members nationwide. WellPoint is the largest member of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It was formed when WellPoint Health Networks Incorporated merged into Anthem Incorporated. Be sure to join us for Angela Braley next month. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.